so this is a little different. But if you could just sort of switch your lens a little bit, I'll be talking about a methodology that that we use to reflect upon a participatory process we used in a human rights approach to mental health recovery. I have relationships disclosed. I do get paid for doing this work by the state of New York. Not much. No, that's not fair. A very broad team of people participated in this research. I was the PI, but many people here, some people have lived experience of mental health, serious mental health diagnoses, others do not. And it was everyone was in the context of the Center to Study Recovery in Social Context, which was funded by the National Institute of Mental Health, to myself and to Kim Hopper, and the New York State Office of Mental Health. So first I want to give you a little sense of this framework of capabilities. We wanted to reframe public mental health as a development project, using some frameworks from international development. And so we chose to look at a capabilities approach, which is used in economic development worldwide. And that was developed by Amartya Sen, a Nobel-winning economist, a couple of decades ago. And the premise of capabilities, the capabilities approach, is that it's not what a nation has or produces. It's people who are the real wealth of nations. It's not the GDP. It's what you can do with the GDP. And so development, rather than just enhancing the amount of dollars that there are in the world, should enlarge human freedoms and expand people's choices to lead full and complete and creative lives. It should also include people not simply as beneficiaries of progress and change, but also as agents of progress and change. I think the part of the title of this session is Resilience and Recovery. And so really, agency is a key piece of this, and that's what our participatory process is about, and that's what we're talking about a lot. And it builds on the participation of each and every person, that democracy thing we have going on sometimes. So capabilities, in the capabilities approach, Amartya Sen approaches development as freedom. Capabilities are substantive freedoms, and there are two sorts of ways of thinking about it. There's both opportunity freedoms that give you the freedom, the opportunities to pursue valued functionings, many of which we've heard about in the previous few presentations. They are the things that people have reason to value and sort of have a right to. What do we owe each other as a society, as a civic body? The opportunity to be safe, to be healthy, not to experience all those adverse childhood experiences, not to experience disparities because of just who we are, to be functionally literate, to participate as citizens, to have housing and to have work. And I will say that the context of this is people with severe mental illness, and some of these we do very poorly on as a culture for that population. So besides those opportunity freedoms, there's also process freedoms, and those are the things that sort of build agency into the framework. What people can do to be participants, builders of change, not just beneficiaries, as Sen puts it, cunning recipients of cunning development projects, which some of us can easily cook up cunning development projects. People should not simply be beneficiaries of them. We should build them together. And so because that's so key, it was important for our framework to figure out what really matters to the community. I mean, if living a real life is about doing and being valued, about the ability to do and be things that you value, what does the community value? And so we used community-based participatory research, which, as you might know, I know there's a lot of CBPR going on in the conference. It's a collaborative approach. It combines inquiry, research, and reflection, and action. And there are some conflicts inherent in that I'll talk about in a little bit. And hopefully what it does is it increases this agentic capacity. It increases people's opportunities to live decent, dignified, and distinctive lives. These are some of the vision statements that have been around for the last decade or so, a little more, about mental health recovery. And you see that there's a real focus on hope and self-management, hope, belief, personal power, respect. And one of the things that sort of drew us into reconceptualizing public mental health as a development project was that we felt that the whole conversation about recovery was very long on hope, and very long on personal meaning, and very short on evidence, and very short on really what was going on. Were people really able to live the lives they valued? And so that was really a key piece for us. And I think that the President's New Freedom Commission, which came out in 2000, really summed up in a very succinct and important and propelling way how public mental health would move towards recovery. How are people able to live, work, learn, and participate fully in their communities? So that came out, the New Freedom Commission report came out around 2000. And this is from the Measure of America, which is a really interesting way to look at how congressional districts, states, and countries are doing in terms of key pieces of human development. If you think about human development, the rights of people, what we owe each other as a society, in terms of just these three major dimensions, a right to health, a long and healthy life, access to knowledge, and a decent standard of living. So if you look at that through the lens of I just want to say to you, there's this book and there's this website called Measure of America, and you can look at your congressional district, your state, look at gender, age, ethnicity breakdowns of health, knowledge, and standard of living for every congressional district in the United States, and it's fascinating, particularly in the context of the theme of this conference, healthography. It is just, it's remarkable the disparities in those key dimensions in contiguous congressional districts. It's just, and even within a congressional district, it's doing really well, the disparities when you look at race and gender. So if you look at it through the lens of behavioral health conditions, these three key things that people may have a right to, what we see is that people with severe mental illness have much less opportunity to live a full and healthy life. They have 25 fewer years of expected life. That number may vary a little bit based on updated looks, but it's a reasonable sort of thumbnail of that. They have very marginal literacy rates. They're about half as likely as people without severe mental illness to have marginal literacy rates, marginal literacy. And they are about three times more likely, households with a person who has severe mental illness, about three times more likely to live in poverty. So in terms of, people's, where is it, that ability to live, work, learn, and participate fully in our communities, people with severe mental illness say not doing so good. And we took we did sort of a back of the envelope look at this in New York State in 2009, and compared our folks to the International Index of Human Development, and found that people with severe mental illness in New York State, which ranks seventh within the United States, which ranks eighth worldwide, people with mental illness in New York State ranked about the level of a citizen of Morocco, which is about 167 out of 180 countries who participate in this index. So talk about disparity. And it's not where you live for this community. I mean, it's really not necessarily healthography. It's a community of disability. You know, it goes across geography, although people certainly concentrate in areas where housing is possible in the public sector. But and this, again, just in contrast to the wonderful visions of recovery and the New Freedom Commission, this was a project that a consumer activist in our center did, and this was how consumers in New York State sort of conceptualized their current state. And you can see that it's a lot about unfreedom. It's a lot about denial. It really is not that positive vision statement of the ability, the capacity to live, work fully. It was about being denied human rights and civil rights and full lifespan, education, participation in the market, choice of tradition. It was all about unfreedom. And this group, we came together with this group of very activated consumer survivors to develop a human rights approach to public mental health and to develop a way to tackle these unfreedoms. And so we used this participatory method throughout our 5 years. And the unfreedoms, the consumer values that Lauren brought to the table were really used to develop and create our research portfolio. Everything we did in the center included consumers' leadership. Every project had had at least one consumer survivor as, if not a principal. They were not simply sort of advisors to the project. They were there to design, to collect data, to help us interpret data. So we asked at the end of toward the middle of the end of our 5 years, well, what makes us participatory? Because I want to tell you, we struggled with this participation thing a lot. So what makes us participatory? We used a mixed methods approach called concept mapping to do this. My partner is an ethnographer, and I'm more of a quantitative type. So we came to a compromise. And used a concept mapping approach. It's a kind of interesting approach uses a group process to brainstorm and develop statements about a particular topic. Here it was what makes us a participatory center. People sort those statements based on similarity and rate the importance of each statement. And then a map is developed using multidimensional scaling. It's a two-dimensional map. The importance ratings ratcheted up to a three-dimensional map. And then hierarchical cluster analysis is used to cluster the statements in ways that they group together. And then it generates several different maps, and then there's a group process to interpret those. 37 people participated in the concept mapping. These really are steadiest participants over time. A little over 100 people participated in the center over the 5 years. These people were mostly Caucasian and largely female, and participated in the center or identified multiple roles in the way they participated. So this is our map about what makes the center participatory. So statements are spanned across this whole map. You can see the clusters, which are the brightly colored little geometric shapes. And then there are, I don't know if you can see it on this map, I can see it on my PowerPoint here. But there are outlines of themes or regions of the map that we did in our interpretive exercises. And those themes were about research, approach, and capacity, relationships, and community. What makes us participatory? Our research, approach, and capacity, our relationships and community, resources and infrastructure, working through meaningful conflict, and ultimately changing how knowledge is created. That was really where we wanted to go, that access to knowledge. We wanted to change that. We wanted to make that a place where people actually were not beneficiaries of my fabulous PowerPoint. We're not just beneficiaries of it, but we're active participants. So in that research approach and capacity, which is the most important, the two clusters, the two themes on your right, research approach and capacity and relationships and community, were the most important. They tied for the most important clusters in the map, the clusters within them. And within research approach and capacity, you see the most central group of statements is this grounding research and lived experience. Not that important, but really central to this whole notion of participation. Also, learning through diverse and conflicting perspectives was really a most important cluster within this theme, and changing research capacity through deliberate reflection was a key piece of this. In grounding research and lived experience, people said the center was on the street and on the ground. It was where you had always hoped research would come, onto the ground. The important statements in diverse and conflicting perspectives had to do with the seminars that we had on a monthly basis that really gave us a regular ongoing opportunity to come to trust each other and to learn through conflicting and diverse perspectives. And one person said, and of course everybody sorted and rated the statement, but it expanded my world in ways that I would not have expected to be possible. And then a not so important cluster, but a pretty cohesive cluster, is the one on changing research capacity. And people said things like, made me question my own mental health beliefs. And we had some pretty radical advocates in the room. So these were folks who were saying there is no such thing as mental illness, and that the centers, that, not to say the state, is full of unfreedoms. And that those beliefs were questioned and came to the center. And researchers said, I questioned how my research is perceived by the consumer survivor community, and I learned to think outside the box. The next, that, no? Within relationships and community, one of the key things was to strengthen the community through the inclusion of multiple stakeholders. And there, this was all about the inclusion of peers on multiple levels, as researchers, as leadership, as partners, and as people who directed how the research portfolio was going to go. One person said, this is the only organization I've ever been in that has had such an extraordinary diversity of stakeholders. And to do that, we had a wide variety of activities, and we had very inclusive learning environments. We broke down barriers to participation, and we did that through just a lot of informal social interaction in those monthly seminars, so that we built trust and so that people across the center felt that they were relating not on credentials but on lived experience, and it was not the lived experience of a mental health problem, it was our lived experience as a community. And then we became aware of missing voices. This was not such an important element, but it was interesting. In such a diverse center, we really were, as you could see when I said who participated in the mapping exercise, we really needed much more cultural diversity, and we also needed more providers in the mix. Resources and infrastructure, the administrators and the leadership of the center thought this was really an important piece, but many people did not think it was so important. But this really had to do with, this really had to do with building a consumer survivor ex-patient community that had social capital to bring outside of the center, and that they could convince, that they really had some credibility at tables that they had not had before they had this pretty intense research grounding in the center. But it also included committing an incredibly unanticipated amount of resources to get this done, to process. It included so much time for process. It included a lot of dead ends. This is research is speaking really to a great extent. It included a lot of invisible work. It was hard work, and the payoff was uncertain. We worked through meaningful conflict, and one person said that, well, the fact that we did that indicated that we were truly participatory. The conflict was really integral to doing participatory research. And there certainly was no shortage of conflict. And it did put people outside their comfort zones. We also felt in that regard that we were often working with no roadmap, no net, that we were outside our comfort zones a lot. It's not an important piece of the map, but it really bridges a great deal of the rest of it. And we felt and went on to try to address what this really was about and how we could come together to move forward as collaborators. I have to say, I don't think we've been successful at that overall, or at least not universally in the work that we did together. And I think, you know, here the second piece of this, you know, some people say, well, what is the price for CBPR? Investigators said, you know, I'm on a tenure track. I gotta get those publications out there. Why am I doing all this work and being sort of driven by a voice that I have to translate all the time? This is investigators. Consumers, survivors were saying, so where's the action? When are we going to get to action? What are we doing all this inquiry for? And there was constant push on power and decision-making, although there was a tremendous amount of sharing of power and decision-making. But, it really is a very challenging process. And I think, you know, that question of success and role expectations, that thing about, you know, how we define our success together as partners moving forward, it's a big, big question. We continue to do participatory research. I think Margie mentioned in her introduction, we're now doing this project called Parachute New York City to integrate peers into the workforce, into the mental health workforce. And it's key and it's critical for people to be agents of change and not simply beneficiaries of change. And it's just something that we all really need to be in that mix and be moving towards what we owe each other as a society to the most vulnerable people, to the children, to the ACE experiencers. We need to do it. So if you want more information on the Recovery Center, which is where this came from, that's the website of it, and that's my contact information. That's on the APHA automatic thing. So thank you very much.
Okay, so are there questions? There are. Okay. So why don't the presenters come up front at this point? Fabulous. Okay. All right. Okay, Kathleen. And we have the chair of the mental health section in the room as well. So, once you ask questions, we're all here.
Mary Jane, I have a question about your discussions around the concept mapping. Something we've been struggling with in our work is that we're hosting stakeholder discussions and trying to get people to tell us what they value and how they prioritize things going forward. And what I begin to see is that the professionals
Yeah, that's exactly it. And I think, you know, we spent a tremendous amount of time and resources, NIMH resources, but also our own personal resources. There was a tremendous devotion to this work and to privileging the unvoiced and to building capacity. And building capacity, you know, it's like two words. Oh, we'll build research capacity. Well, you know, yeah, it really is a whole parallel set of activities that you do. I was talking to a couple of other people who do CBPR in a planning process, and I was thinking, man, why didn't we do it in a planning process? It's so much easier. Because at least we're all speaking a language, you know, there's a more common playing field in terms of the language. So I think when you're dealing with these difficult technical concepts, like research, I mean, we did, our field school was a full year of didactics and exercise, and it was really like a little mini training school in research for folks. Folks are very challenged. If you're dealing with a low-income population or people who are, you know, as you have noted in some of your talks, you know, people who are struggling with just getting life together, much less the challenges of a, you know, a challenged child, and then these conceptual pieces. I think you've got to build the knowledge. I mean, because, you know, one of our consumers said that that having the knowledge enabled them to come to the table more as peers. Having research knowledge enabled them to question their own sort of go-to gut responses, which is how people might do the valuing that you're talking about, and it also gave them some cred. That's what it's about, building the credit. You need time, and you need money.
Other questions?
Good question.
Yes, back here. But one of the things I wanted to ask you
Well, you know, that's really, you're absolutely right. I mean, it spans this much of a spectrum. And we kind of jumped into the middle of this running deep stream. And perhaps I wish we hadn't, maybe. I think we were a little naive in doing it that way. And we really had the great privilege of having an NIMH grant. We were able to pay people for participation. I mean, in a big way, we were able to pay people. We got array money, you know, the supplement in 2009, I think, to develop this field school. That was a full year of a really solid, steady didactic. So you're right, participation can mean, yeah, we invited some people in, but I think, you know, it's how seriously do you take it and do your partners take it? And there are so many pieces, that's why I want to talk about the elements of it. There's so many pieces of it that are challenging. There are structural challenges. The administrative, if you pay a person to come to the table, which is respectful of their time and their knowledge, their expertise, their lived experience, what does that do to their benefits? You know, especially if their benefits is, one of their benefits is housing in New York City. What does that do to that? I mean, it becomes an enormous problem that we were committed to figuring out with people. So that level of participation takes a great deal of resources, just really institutional resource and commitment. Bringing people to the table and having coffee, you know, it's another thing. But I think that to be genuine, you need to level the playing field in terms of knowledge, as Kathleen really sort of suggests is needed for this sort of complex technical question that we're asking people to participate around. I really think that's like a really integral piece of doing it. You've got the money to pay people. And then a lot of it is just your personal capacity to be there with the conflict and the no roadmap. And I mean, that's all really true. Yeah, we are. That's why I'm nodding. We are, and we did. I mean, we've continued to employ some folks who went through our field school as research assistants on projects. The workforce integration piece in the Parachute project is pretty breathtaking, and the whole move towards transforming systems to be person-centered is going to push that, right? I mean, the certification of peer specialists, the hiring of peer specialists, but then there's a lot of things to be worked out in that little neck of the woods as well. But we had people. We had people finishing a bachelor's degree. We had a person went on to become a paralegal. And it's that practical reasoning, you know, that first slide I talked about in the framework, where capabilities are two things. They're substantive and they're process freedoms. And it's really that piece is developing that practical reasoning capacity, and which builds on it. It's a development process. It builds on itself.
Yeah, that's a very good question, and actually what the direct answer to that is there is no such like regular or mandatory screening things, and now it is pretty much on depending on the clinics or on the practitioner. So some of them prefer, for example, the clinics which participate in these kind of studies, they have made it a practice to give a test like be it the CSD or BDI or whatever. However, it is not something that like it is being done on a regular basis and in all of the clinics. So that I feel that is something that needs to be done, because a lot of times the first instance when depression is diagnosed in women is during their postpartum period, and it could be that they are having it since their pregnancy or maybe even before that. So it is important to keep that in mind.
Going in my head and thinking about the data that I have available on the data set. You know, for this study, what we really did want to look at was this idea of sort of adverse experiences in one's context. So mostly in their family and neighborhood context and their economic context, which really fit in their family. But I think that we do have a couple measures of subjective stress, particularly in adulthood. And I think looking at that will help also sort of delve into this idea of the spirals of loss idea. I mean, if stress is a mediator, which we found in our study, then it's important to understand why. I mean, could it be that, and some of the literature suggests that abuse leads to more stressful experiences externally, but it also leads you to internalize things that other people might not internalize. So looking at that perception piece of it would be a really important question to follow up about the mediation. Is it that you are triggering more external events of stress, or is it that you're internalizing, or external events of stress, or is it that you're internalizing the experiences in such a way that it leads more to depression? So,
yeah, no, I think that's a great response, and that's likely both of those things
mm-hmm.
happening. And one of the tricky stress, I kind of think of those external experiences as the stressors, and then stress being maybe your response to the stressors, but that's been a difficult measurement question in terms of how we look at stress in general, and sometimes it is just a tally of events, but you're so right that to some people, what we might think is a stressful event is actually fine, and that it really has to do with the capacity people feel they have to address and deal with that stressor, which then varies a lot by socioeconomic circumstances and other resources that are in place, so all of those.
It's interesting. I mean, it points too to the importance of doing mixed method research,
mm-hmm.
right? Because we could get a quantitative idea, and certainly, like my study gave me a quantitative idea of how stress fits in. But I mean, stress is so much about meaning making, so we have to really understand how are people making meaning of the events that are happening in their lives and the chronicity of it.
Yeah, and then I'd also add on that I think one of the interesting things we found, and why I was suggesting looking at biomarkers earlier, we can have different ways of capturing stress that is seen in the body, kind of experienced in the body, that could be telling as well. Sometimes people might report that they're doing okay, but there's another story going on if we look at what's happening in there in themselves, you know. So that'd be interesting to pair those together.
With respect to the challenge to researchers, you know, some of the challenges for researchers are structural. You know, it has to do with the tenure, the publication, the tenure, the time thing, and the length of time it takes to do CPPR. And I don't know that we can do anything about that. I think we're just stuck with that. I don't think any of us who were incredibly well-intentioned would be into this. I think we did real great with the whole thing about the power dynamics. Now, maybe it's a generational thing, but I felt uncomfortable talking about that as a central piece of this, as a central challenge, because I felt that here we were. You know, we had written this grant. It, you know, had taken a lot of energy, and we were clearly committed. And we, you know, were putting. I compared us to. There's some stats out now about CBPR projects and how the resources that are committed to the community and the academia. We're way out there. We gave a lot of our money out. I mean, I felt like you know, and I would say, power dynamics. What are you talking about, power dynamics? You know, we're out here. We're doing it all. I think some way of grappling with that in a trusting way to begin with, and I think we should have early on reflected on whether we were all good partners, the researchers and the advocates. I think we were not quite on the same page, and to you know we had a lot of language wars for a long time. And, you know, so some of these things distracted us. And then on the researcher side, there were investigators who kept saying, well, the technical skill is what determines how the question is asked. And, you know, I think, you know, there may have been mismatches, and we should have, you know, reevaluated that and agreed to be separated and, you know, date somebody else. or to reframe, you know, our common goals. So, I have a paper written.
So, it's 2:00. Oh. So, there's time for you to just. And then maybe finish the conversation.
Okay. So, you want to shut this? I just want to say that I have a paper written, and it sits there. And because it's two dimensional. And it just is there. And I don't know how to.
Yeah.
Okay.
It might be a topic of discussion within the structure about how to just kind of research people's experiences. So there's a lot of folks who do it.
Yeah, I think that. And some activists also in the room. You know, I could say more.
Maybe a
planning session.
So we'll see you guys all in Chicago. Have a safe journey home.